Thank you. Thank you guys for having me again. Maren Hartwood, Grateful Recovered Alcoholic. I really appreciate this group and what it stands for. And there's I typically, during the week, I'm usually working about 6 days a week, and I get off on Sundays because of the blue laws. You can't sell cars in New Jersey or Pennsylvania on Sundays. So I automatically have that off. They'd probably make me work if that wasn't the case. However, I got a chance to spend some time with my kids today, and you can learn a ton when it comes to spirituality from small kids. So I have a 9, 8, and 6-year-old, and we went to a little park right around the corner. We just moved, so we're just kind of finding our way around the neighborhood, and we walked over to this park, and there was probably like 4 or 5 other kids. All of them were a good younger than even my youngest. They were probably like 2 or 3, and to watch my kids like really hone in on the little ones, and really the first thought was, how can they help these new friends of theirs? How can they help them like navigate the playground? And like, because my kids have been there like twice, but they're experts now, right? So it's like they were helping them in every capacity, showing them every little bit, and it reminded me of what I used to talk about years ago when I first started speaking in AA, was our innate ability as human beings to be helpful and useful, right? That's, we kind of have an ingrained want and desire to be useful, to be helpful. It's built into us as children, and you'll notice that if you ever get a chance to hang out with little kids, they want to help, right? And they see someone struggling or crying or whatever, and they're little, and they go up to them and ask them, "What's wrong? Or are you okay? Can I help?" Like that, it's built into us. Right, and it's a cool thing to be able to see that. And then now looking, you know, back, and I don't have to look back all that far, like how selfish that I can be, right? How a lot of times my thoughts don't always align with way the big book asks us to align our thoughts, right? And that's by design. I think we're supposed to be, you know, kind of connected to God and then disconnected from God. And what does the book do? The book gives me a spiritual kit of tools that was laid at my feet and the ability to get connected again, right? And then the spiritual connection, not in wine and spirits, right, which is what we used to do, in a spiritual connection when it comes to God or our higher power. So I just thought it was cool. I just wanted to share with the group how kind of humbling it is when these small kids can kind of just knock us back into place, right, in a sweet and sincere way. So last week we were talking about step three. We read about step three is the only step in the book where it tells you, or the first step in the book where it tells you you are here, kind of like the map at the mall, right, where it tells you you're here. So step three, first of all, we had to be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success, right? So there's a convincing process in the third step. And then he goes on to describe the actor, right? The actor is trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, right? If everything would just go the way that I say it's going to go, then everyone would be happy. And then he tells us what usually happens, right? The show doesn't come off very well. Right, it comes off, and I step on the toes of my fellows, right? Or they step on mine, and they retaliate seemingly without provocation, and I don't know what's going on, and I'm angry, I'm restless, irritable, discontented, right? And that's what the doctor's opinion says. Doctor's opinion says, Dr. Silkworth says, the alcoholic is restless, irritable, and discontent until they can feel the effects of ease and comfort that come from a couple drinks, right? So what am I really after? Right, and when we sit down with the newcomer, a lot of times, and this is what I thought in the very beginning, that my problem was alcohol. Turns out that's not the case. Alcohol was my solution to my problem. Right, my problem was restless, irritable, and discontented. What was I really looking for? Ease and comfort. Right, and so alcohol was there to do that. It gave me a certain sense of ease and comfort. It's amazing how the mind kind of is warped around addictive substances like alcohol. I don't know if you've ever been to a place like this, but sitting outside of like a liquor store, right, and waiting for it to open up, and then they finally pop the open sign on and unlock the door, and you go inside and grab your bottle of whatever it is, right, and automatically once the bottle is in your hand, right, those kind of withdrawal symptoms tend to go away. Right, so and no matter what substance you're using, a lot of them kind of fall into the same realm. The power that alcohol has on the mind is really, because every time I relapse, I did it sober, right? So my sober mind says alcohol is a good idea, Right? So that's the whole, that's what we're up against. The book tells me over and over again that suddenly, right? And then they uses the micro stories within the first 164 pages where he talks about, you know, without a cloud on the horizon, everything was amazing. And then suddenly I walked through the threshold of the dining room and I thought a couple highballs would be a good idea, right? Like that's what we're really up against, is we're up against the mind, right? We're up against our own mind. And so if our mindset doesn't change, more than likely an untreated alcoholic will drink again. Right. So, and I know that's not the nicest thing to say to newcomers, right? But it's the truth. The truth, right, as they say, shall set you free. And as we walk through, as they talk about this archway through freedom, and it comes through truth, to thine own self be true, right? So the third step, and I'm convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success, right? I have a difficult time managing my emotional states, right? I'm either up here or down here. I have a difficult time connecting with others. I have a very hard time understanding or having any sort of empathy towards anybody else. I feel like the loneliest person in a room full of people. I think I'm great, and yet I feel like I'm not all at the same time. It's all kind of lumped in. And alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do to the general population, right? Because that's what makes us alcoholic, really. Not what alcohol does to us, but what alcohol does for us that makes us alcoholic. So then I put alcohol in my system and something changes, right? I trigger the allergy, as the doctor's opinion talks about. An allergy is an abnormal reaction to a substance, right? So when I put alcohol in my system, I have a different reaction than the general population. Most of the time, somebody, like if my mom, for example, who's definitely non-alcoholic, right? She puts a drink in her system, she starts to feel like out of control. Her stomach starts to hurt. Like she doesn't feel right, right? Mine is the exact opposite reaction. Like I feel great, I feel in control, and I want more, right? I have a much different reaction. So that's what an allergy is defined as, an abnormal reaction to a substance. So then my mind says, right, when we're sober again, let's do that again, in spite of, right, whatever may have just happened, whatever consequences there might be. So I have no ability to quote unquote play the tape all the way through. I know if it's been said in AA that just remember your last drunk and you won't drink. It's like, man, that is terrible advice for an alcoholic. Like it's not the case. If I could just remember my last drunk and not drink, why would we need AA? Right? Why would we need God? Why would we need the steps? We wouldn't. I would just be like, oh man, that was embarrassing, right? Not going to do that again. Or man, I don't want to get locked up again. Or man, that mental institution, whew, like I don't want to go back there again. And yet, over and over and over again, right? The idea to drink completely supersedes anything that was before that. And so again, that's what we're really up against, is the mindset, right? So if I'm convinced that any life around self-will can hardly be a success, that's a great start. But now what is it that we do, right? So the kind of the movement from the third step into the fourth step dives from the third step prayer, right? So page 63, if you want to follow along. We are now at step 3, right? So all of this convincing process, all of this about the actor, and now you're at step 3. We have to be convinced first. And if you're working with a newcomer, and they're not convinced of those vital issues that we just went over between pages 60 and 63, go back and read them again. Or possibly they're not ready for whatever, or maybe they're not real alcoholic, maybe they're not one of us. There's more questions that need to be asked of them. But if they are convinced at this point, then we are now at step 3. Many of us have said to our Maker as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. And we got to think of the third step is, who's it really leaving out? In there, it's leaving out like me, right? It's telling me that, like, if the bondage of self, right? So, self in this scenario is constricting, it's holding, it's pressing, it's keeping me in one place, right? So, if you can relieve me, notice how he doesn't say remove, right? It's relieve. I just need some relief from the bondage of self, so like the light can get in, right? I just need some movement, right, so I can get out of the straitjacket, is really kind of the idea. So that's all we're really asking for, is relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? To do your will, right? To do God's will. And what does that turn out to be? I hate to ruin the end of the story for you, but that turns out to be helping other alcoholics. Like that's the whole idea. I can explain what it's like to feel like an alcoholic in active addiction much better than someone who's got a doctorate in addiction from some of the best schools in the world. They might be able to understand scientifically or what happens to the, you know, dopamine serotonin response when someone puts drugs or alcohol in their system, but that pales in comparison to sitting across the table from someone who felt the same way you do, but doesn't feel that way anymore. Pales in comparison. A message of depth and weight, right? That's what Silk Course calls. That's what they have to have, right? In order to catch the alcoholic or have their attention. A message of depth and weight. So then, I would do thy will, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking the step, making sure that we are ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. This is an interesting point, right? So from the third step on, there's always a slight reference in every other step to the third step. It asks us, okay, remember, you were willing to go to any lengths, right? Especially in the ninth step. It actually does it twice in the ninth step. It reverts us back to the third step. It's just like, hey, you just remember what you were discussing here, what you felt like here, right? Thought well before making sure we were ready, right? And what's the age old, how do we know if we're ready? If you're asking that question, you're ready, right? It's the whole idea of like, am I alcoholic? Like anyone that asks that probably is, right? Anyone that's like, well, I'm going to count my drinks tonight. It's like, damn, normal people don't do that. Right, I mean, really, we chuckle about it because as alcoholics, we're like, well, you know, I had to have six before I got to the place, and then I had to have a stash in the car. Like that's the way our brains were so warped around it. Like that was normal, right? People who are non-alcoholic do not think like that. They don't think like, oh, I'm just going to go to happy hour. I'm going to have two drinks. I'm going to see Fred and Larry, and then I'm going to leave. Like that's not how it works. They're like, oh, well, maybe we should go out. Okay, cool, and they go. Right? And it's just different. It's different. It's just a different mindset typically for them. So we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. Now that sentence right there is an interesting one. The word spiritual advisor is the closest thing you'll find to the word sponsor in the first 164 pages of the book. I dare you to challenge me on it. Read through it word for word. It ain't in there. Right? But spiritual advisor is the closest you're going to get to a sponsor in the big book. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we express the idea, voicing it without reservation. He's talking about the wording of the third step, right? Does it say, memorize this third step, you have to know it, you have to know it verbatim? No. Right, a shorter version of the third step, which is what I've honed in on, because I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed, right? So I have to have something that's quick and easy to remember, right? And it's God save me from me, so I can help you, right? That's really what the third step kind of boils down to. God save me from me, because I'm the problem, right? So if I'm the problem, there was a guy that used to go to meetings years ago. He would that's what he would say. My name and my problem is Phil. Right, that's how he would introduce himself. And hey, it's like, ain't that the truth, right? Like that's the case. I want to blame everybody else, and then we're going to round the corner into resentment shortly, and discuss like where that kind of flawed logic of blaming other people where it falls short, right? But and of course, it was quite optional. So long as we express the idea, right, the idea of the third step, the kind of spirit of the third step, voicing it without reservation, right? And the reservation is a delay or placing it somewhere else. You know, that's the idea. Like, as long, what's without reservation mean? I have $20 in my pocket and the open sign's on at the liquor store. Like, that's without reservation, I'm going in, right? Like, that's we've done it with everything, right? We've done it so many different times. Or like, you know, there's somebody I want to go talk to at this party. Like, I'm going there without reservation, right? Whatever the case is, like, that's what they're asking us to do. This was only the beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Again, this is an internal feeling, right, on the third step. You might feel it, you might not, but sometimes it's a great effect, especially if you have someone guiding you through this third step that's pretty versed in this stuff and is able to kind of walk you through the process of what the third step really is and what it isn't, right? And so then you might be able to have an effect at once. Sometimes not. Now, the next word tells us when we should be doing the fourth step. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Let's chop this sentence up for a second, right? So back when this book was written between 1937 and 1939, they weren't launching rockets. They didn't know what rockets, that's not what they were launching. What were they launching? Boats. Right? And when they launched boats, did they have these awesome GPS systems where they knew where they were going? No. Did they have the ability to kind of track what the weather was going to be outside of the farmer's almanac? No. Right? Were they able to see a big storm coming their way? Or no. Why would they do it? And how would they do it? They would do it in faith. Faith that they were going to be able to like hone in on the North Star, right? And be able to like figure that out. So next we launched out. So launch is not necessarily this like big rocket boost. Launch is like, let's set out and put the sails up in faith that what we're about to do is going to change the course of our lives forever, right? On a course of vigorous action, right? Not just regular action, but good old-fashioned vigorous action, right? It's like if you have to do a job that you're getting paid for and it's not hourly, like you can get it done as quick as you want and then you can roll and get the same amount of money. Like that's vigorous, right? Go dig that hole and I'll give you $200. Like, no problem. I would knock it out as quick as I could so I could roll, get my $200 and be done, right? That's vigorous action, right? There's a difference between action and vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. It's funny because, of course not. Why would I do that when I could literally point the finger at somebody else for so many years and say it's their fault, right? Why would I do a personal house cleaning when I could like pick on their house, right, or degrade them? Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless followed at once by strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. What did that just tell us, right? Ever been to a big book meeting where they just read the whole chapter and they blaze right through it and then they share about their day afterwards? Like, this sentence is huge. What did it just tell me? The decision, right, the third step, right, was vital. Vital means life-giving. If you don't have vital signs, you are dead, right? So a crucial step, it could have little permanent effect. Permanent. Like, we're not talking about a transitory in and out. Like this, it's literally telling us that the third step can have a permanent effect if, right, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. That's the inventory. Causes and conditions. That's what it is. We're learning what's blocking us from us becoming our full potential and what God created us to be. Right? Not to do, but to be. Human beings, not human doings. Right? So what did God create us to be? Right? I'm blocked from those things. Something is blocking me from getting there. I have to figure out what that is, the cause of those things, and the conditions by which they still exist. That's what the inventory is all about. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsellable goods, to get rid of them promptly without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure, right? It's what we're made of. It's part of us. It's not these things on the outside that we can just peel off. It's part of who we are, right? The flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Here's where we dive into the actual, like, this is the common manifestations of a life run on self-will run riot, right? An extreme example of self-will run riot. That's what we are. That's what we're driven by, 100 forms of fear and self-delusion, right? That's what it's telling me. The third step told me all this, and I'm convinced of all this. Now, what are its common manifestations? Resentment is the number one offender. Why do they put the number one in quotes? It's about to tell you. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. So he puts it in quotations because it's not only the number one, it's the only one. From it, resentment, stems all forms of spiritual disease. Right? So resentment is a Latin word, sentar, which means to feel. So resentment means to re-feel the same emotion over and over and over again. Real or imagined. That's what resentment is. And it's the number one offender. What did it just tell me? Gave me another, it's gonna give me a death threat here coming up. But telling me here, it's not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Good old fashioned. You guys remember algebra, right? Remember order of operations, PEMDAS, right? It just told me how to get well and what order to do it, right? It told me right here, when the spiritual malady is overcome, when that happens, we straighten out mentally and physically. There's our order of operations. Right? So it's to start with the spirit, and then everything else will flow after that. Right? Start with the spirit. I know. I wish I could tell you guys, listen, 100 push-ups a day, you're going to be good to go, you'll be all squared up, and then spirituality is going to come to you. I wish I could tell you, oh, just go back to school, get your doctorate, and you'll be rocking. Like, all those things are good. There's nothing wrong with those. But again, it's the cart before the horse. These folks wrote this book because this was effective, because it worked. Right? That's why they put them. And so he told us this in this order for a very specific reason. Notice how it says not like if the spiritual malady is overcome. It's saying when it is. Right? The wording here is very important. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, we found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it self-esteem, our security, ambition, personal relations, or sex relations which had been interfered with? And he gives us a good example. Let me give you a real-life example from my inventory. So the first person on my inventory was my father. So, and what I just put dad, right? And then we asked ourselves why we were angry. So why am I angry at him, right? He never told me he loved me, never told me he was proud of me, and I never thought I'd live up to his expectations, right? That was there. I see the paper, the cheap, you know, dollar store in line to pay, like I see it, like I wrote it, I remember, like this was, you know, early 2015 when I wrote this, when I just got out of rehab, like I wrote it, and I remember, I see it still there, and then, so my sponsor kind of leaned back in his chair and he asked me a question, and he said, you know, how was your father raised? Right? And no one in AA had ever asked me anything like this. The only thing they were asking me was, like, how are you? I'd come off just this horrific bender. And I'd come back into AA and I'd raise my hand. I'd get my little desire trip. And they'd be like, yeah, how are you? Like, what? That's a terrible question, too. We know how the newcomer is. Beaten, broken, sad, depressed. It's not pretty. And yet, what do you say when someone says, how are you? I'm good, thanks. Like, why are we begging the newcomer to lie to us right from the rip? Like, we're talking about honesty. Like, if a newcomer comes in and they're pretty badly mangled, as the book says, like, instead of asking them how they are, why don't we tell them we have a way out? Like, I know what that feels like, my man. Like, that hurts. Like, it's not pretty. I've been there. Right? Not there anymore. You interested in what we have to offer? Right? Like, that's a lot different than, hey, I'm going to love you till you love yourself. Good luck, pal. We'll see you tomorrow night at the meeting, right? There's a big difference between those two things, right? One is actual action to help the newcomer, and the other one is just kind of pushing it along and saying, think. And the thought is always like, oh, you know what? If he really wants it, he'll go out or she'll go out and they'll figure this thing out. Like, no, they won't. They're probably going to die. Right, so if we're going to take the odds of this whole thing, I'm not an odds guy, but the idea is anyone who's alcoholic and not drinking is beating the odds. So the fact that they are here, reaching out for help, maybe not verbally or putting their hand out, but they walk into AA is just as big of a, I need help, than anything I've ever heard before. Right? They're screaming it without saying a word. So what are we offering them? Right? What's the offer to the newcomer? Right? Is it just a place to sit for an hour so they can get away from whatever's going on out there? That ain't so bad. All right, that's something. Right? But what about when they're out there? That's where we slip. It's like, I'm offering them something for an hour. Good. Like, a safe place, people who understand each other, collective intelligence, like, all the love in the world, and maybe we can hit them with some hope, and maybe they'll just feel a little bit better walking out of here than when they walked in. Good. Rock on. Awesome. But what about the other 23 hours? Like, there's got to be more to it. There's got to be more substance to this thing. So when we're talking, and then, so my sponsor leaned back and he asked me how my father was raised, and no one had ever asked me that before. And I said, my father was raised by an abusive alcoholic father who physically abused him, his siblings, and his mother every single day until he turned 18 and went in the Navy and never went back. So then my sponsor kind of looked at me square in the eyes and he said, did your father ever physically abuse you? And I don't know how many inventories I've heard, and it's not to brag, but hundreds of inventories, and there are some really rough things that happen to people. Okay? And so that's just not my experience with this particular man. And he had never physically abused me. And mental stuff was there, but he never physically did. And so I told him no. And at that time, I had two sons. Today I have three, but at that time I had two. And he leans back in his chair and he looks at me and just says, so you mean to tell me your father may have stopped the cycle of physical abuse from father to son in your family tree forever? Did you ever consider that? It's like, oh, no, I didn't consider that. I only saw what he didn't say or didn't do to me. Like, I never saw it that way. He made me take a look at my relationship with my dad from an entirely different angle. Right? All of a sudden, it melted away. Like, oh my God, like, he just did the best he could, which was way better than what he got. Way better. In comparison, if I'm just going to just look at on a piece of paper how he was raised and how I was raised, they are dramatically different. Dramatically different. It made me see him differently in that moment. It didn't make the resentment go away, but it made me look at it, bless you. It made me look at it different, right? From an entirely different angle, right? So I was selfish, right? I was never honest with him. I was 100% dishonest with him once I learned how to lie. That I was never straightforward and honest with my old man. Like, I never told him, I was never straight anything. It was always just beat around the bush and not say anything and hide from him, lock myself in my room and whatever. Like, it was never, I never had that kind of relationship with him. I never even tried, right? So it completely shifted the way I thought about that. And then it made me realize that every single other adult male figure in my life, I had the same resentment towards. I never thought they were going to be proud of me, and I never thought I'd live up to their expectations. Every single adult male, friends, teachers, family, everyone, that resentment tattooed itself onto every adult male figure in my life. That's how dangerous resentments are. That's how deadly they are. Right, and you want to talk about resentment, and you want to get a real life idea of how resentful you might be, put on the news channel that you don't normally watch, right? And then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, I hate that person for saying that, and it's like, whoa, like, resentments are deadly for us. Like, we're looking at this as, well, you know, I'm at least not drinking. Like, that's not. No. Like, that, okay, not drinking is a good start. Okay, don't get me wrong. Like, it's a good thing, right? But there's so much more to it than just that. Like, one resentment can, from there, tattoo itself onto other people as you go along. Or that one resentment can pull you deep into this quicksand. And then all of a sudden, what are we? Restless, irritable, discontented. What are we going to try to fix that? We'll try food. We'll try energy drinks. We'll try, I don't know, lustful thoughts. You name it. Lustful actions, gambling. Oh, we're still sober. right? But we're still trying to like feel better about this resentment. Like something's trying to, and we might not consciously know we have this resentment. So we're having this resentment and then we're going out there and acting stupid in other ways. And then it's like, well, why am I doing this? Well, I don't really know. And well, we should probably take inventory on it. No, it's good. I already did one inventory. It's like, oh man, step 10. That's the cleanup step. Like we're supposed to be inventorying all the time. Like constantly. Like that's the whole purpose. Continue to take personal inventory. That's what the step is. Right? One inventory ain't gonna cut it, unfortunately. I wish it was. Then you just do one and be done. Not the case. So with this particular one, and then we get them as we go along. Someone cuts us off in traffic and whatever. It's like they're deadly if held on to. Right? Resentment corrodes the container that it's held in. Right? So if I'm holding on to resentment, like the other person, the person that cut me off in traffic is not thinking about me being angry at them for very long. Once I'm gone out of their rear view, that's it. Right? But me, I'm hanging right on to that. Right? Oh, and they had the red Nissan Altima, and I'm just going, they're terrible people, and it's just bam, 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 bam. And then I can't see a red Nissan Altima without thinking it's them. And then all of a sudden I go to work and something not great happens at work, and then it spills into that, and I get sharp at somebody, or I say something I shouldn't say, or I don't say something I should say, or whatever it might be, and then work kind of just goes terribly, and it's all downhill. And then I get home, and my spouse is trying to like figure out what's wrong with me, and I just don't want to say anything, and it's just like toppling over and over and over again. Is it because this guy cut me off in traffic? No, it's because I'm not treating the resentment. I'm not treating what's actually wrong with me. And it's not that they cut me off in traffic. It's that I think I'm more important than they are. And how dare they cut me off? And my time's more important than theirs. Like, how dare they do that to me? And like, that's where I really am. Right? And if we can recognize that, and that's where the inventory comes in. That's where I learn to recognize the makeup, the parts of self that I bring to the table. Right? The parts of self, and again, it's like the actor comes up again, and constantly, it's all the time, like, what stage character am I bringing to work today? Like, what stage character am I bringing home today? What stage, it's like, it's so exhausting. It really, really is. And when we can take a step back and look and be like, wow, like, okay, so that stage character there is doing this and this and this. So like, you know, why are we doing this? Why? It's because there's a part of self that feels like it's not good enough. Right? There's a part of self. There's a self-esteem issue. There's a whatever it might be. There's all sorts of stuff that's going on with people like us. And even the book talks about it on page 133. Like, doctors, therapists, and psychologists are indispensable to the newcomer. Like, thank God for people like that. Because they can help somebody like me. But if I don't clear this crap out, there's no way I'm going to be able to be honest with a therapist or psychologist. No way. You don't have to admit this if you don't want to. But have you ever paid a therapist or psychologist and lied to them? Yeah, okay. Let the record show a couple hands went up, okay? It's not just mine, right? So, but why do we do that? Because we still want to paint them a good picture of who we are, and yet we are in therapy. It's absurd. It's like the idea of, well, I don't want to have that conversation with someone because I know how it's going to go. Again, you don't have to admit this if you don't want to. Have you ever had a full-blown conversation with someone in your head and then not had it in real life because you know how it's going to go? Yeah, let the record show more hands went up than the other time. Right, but it's like that is, I'm sorry, lunacy. And I do it all the time. I'm going to ask my boss for a raise. Well, he's going to say this. And then I'm going to say this. And then we're going to, you know, then this is going to happen. And then there's, like, whoa, we do it with, we do it with amends too. Let's be honest with ourselves. We do it with amends. If you sit down with a newcomer and you get to the amends part and they're like, well, I'm going to make an amends to my mom because it's going to be easy. They're like, oh, you don't even know. Like, what are you making amends for? Are you making amends? Like, this is the way I made amends to my mom. I sat down, I looked her square in the eye. She's already crying, right? Because she knows what's coming. And I told her, Mom, it's not your fault that I'm alcoholic. Ooh. Like, for her, like, resentment's not to free, or amends are not to free me. They're to free them. Like, that's another perspective. Like, well, I want to make an amends so I can feel better. It's like, man, you are wrong. It's not what the book says. Right? The book says we're chained to people. And we need to break the chain so they can be free. And we're chained to everybody else. And a resentment chains me to that person. And they might not even know it. right? So when I made that amends to my mom, right, and she just broke, she was already crying, and she just broke right on down. And she's like, well, I could have been, and I said, Mom, I need you to stop. It's not your fault that I'm alcoholic. It's not your fault that I was addicted to drugs. It's not your fault. Right? Like, it's just not. And there's, maybe there's a genetic component in there, but it's still not her fault, right? She didn't choose her genetics, right? Like, no one chooses the genetics. So maybe there was a genetic component, but you can't feel bad about that. I can't feel bad about the genetics I passed on to my kids, right? They have it. Like, that's one way or the other, like, I can't change that. I can change the way that I view the world and the way I interact with them and the way I interact with the world around them. And I can kind of mold the way that they see or view others. And there's certain things that I can really do to help kind of guide and shift them. It's the same thing with sponsorship in AA. Like, I can't, like, change the way somebody's thinking. I can't make them think a different way. But what I can do is I can lay the evidence on the table that if we do a couple of things, your thinking will change, right? And the only way to find out if I'm wrong is to actually do it, right? That's really the case. Like, oh, you don't believe me that the obsession to use drugs or alcohol has been removed from me since December 27, 2014? Like, you don't believe that? That's okay. I'm not asking you to believe that. I want you to prove me wrong and do exactly everything that I did in the exact time frame that I did, and then tell me I'm wrong. Right? That's really what it comes down to. Like, how can you know? Like, this is a personal experience gig. Right? This is not a, like, well, you know, the book is designed to walk you through the steps, but each experience is going to be different. Notice how in the third step, at the end of the third step, it says you might feel a little some during here. You might or you might not. Either way, that's cool. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. So as we write down our resentments, we're putting to paper all the people, institutions, and principles that we're angry at, right? Those are kind of our threefold, right? People, places, things, isn't that? That's a little bit different. But the idea is we write all the people. Typically, that's the biggest bulk of it. Institutions, I don't know, the IRS, the prison, whatever, you name it. There's a few of them, right? And then principles, you know, things like honesty or integrity or the institution, or whatever, or marriage or some whatever. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff, and divorce court, and I mean, you name it. Like, there's as many as you can even think of, right? There's bunches, right? So we put that all on paper and we look at it, right? And it tells us that we were hurt, we were burned up. And then we write why we're resentful, and then was it our self-esteem? Was it our security? Our ambitions, personal or sex relations that were interfered with. And the paragraph before that, it even lumps in, like, pocketbook, like, did it hurt my money situation or my ambition, right? Did it hurt any of those things? Like, were any of those hurt or threatened? Right? That's a whole nother key to this whole thing. Like, my self-esteem was hurt, you know, but, you know, maybe it hurt my ambition. Like, no, it probably threatened your ability to be ambitious, right? If you're angry at a boss for not giving you a raise for 10 years, like, your ambitions were just cut down at the knees. Like, why would I work hard for this person who doesn't see my value to give me more money? Like, that obviously hurt your ambition. Like, going through this with somebody who's got a keen eye for a few of these things, and the most important thing is not afraid to tell you the truth. Right? If you're going through this with someone and you're afraid to tell them the truth, the best thing you can do is either take that fear and inventory it and figure out why it is that you think that the way they feel about you is more important than you helping them. Right? That's the biggest thing. Like, why we're not so truthful with people is because we care too much about what they think about us. Right? That's really why it's difficult for a lot of people to tell the straightforward truth. Obviously, we're not trying to hurt anybody. I'm not going to, like, tell someone they look bad in a particular shirt or something. That's not what I'm. That's not what I'm after. What I'm after is when someone comes into AA, let's tell them the truth. Like, you're sick and you're probably going to die, right? Because that's what happens to alcoholics who go untreated, right? So, if that's the case, are you interested in our solution that we have to offer? If you are, then rock on. Like, let's square this up. Let's go have a cup of coffee and talk about a couple of things. Take a little action and see where we go from there. Right? Let's move forward with this deal. As opposed to, you know, let me make sure you're serious about it. Make 90 meetings in 90 days and then we'll talk about the steps. Like, that's deadly for a lot of people. Right? I know from personal experience, I was 13 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. In and out of AA. You know, just not drinking, making meetings, figuring out the slogan so I could sound like I'm doing okay. Right? That was the actor I was playing in AA, was the guy who's put himself together finally. Right? And then, you know, I would speak at your meetings, I would drink your coffee, I would occupy a chair. I wasn't doing any step work. I wasn't helping anybody. I just wanted to come in, look like I was doing okay, and roll out. That's all I was doing. And then I would go back out, and then I would drink again. I'd come back in, raise my hand, get my little desire chip. You know, I'm really going to do it this time. It's like, you're already off to a bad start, because you can't do anything. Right, I go to rehabs and I speak at rehabs, and you know, I have people raise their hands and I say, you know, how many of you have been to two or more rehabs? And most of them raise their hand. And how many of you have been to like five or more? And then they raise a couple more, raise their hand, and then about 10 or more, and then there's some that have been there 15, 20 rehabs. Right? And those are the same ones that'll say, well, I know what I gotta do this time. I'm sorry, Buckaroo, you got no clue what you got to do, right? And that's okay. In fact, that's a good thing. Like if you come in and know, thinking you know what you're going to do, it's like my first day on the job and I'm at training. It's like, I got this. Like, nah, that doesn't really work that way. Like maybe you take the training and then stumble through a couple things, and then it'll get, and then maybe you'll figure it out, right? Then maybe, just maybe. Right, so that's the idea. We walk them through the process, simple and easy, straightforward, tell them the truth. Try not to lie to them, right? Try not to tell them things that are untrue. Even the popular things that people like to say, they're good and they're well-meaning, and I get it. No one wakes up in the morning and says, you know, I'm going to spout some one-liners and kill some people in AA. Like, I know they don't wake up and do that. Like, that's not the case. But the point is, if we're working with someone, whatever speed they go through the steps, it doesn't matter. Get them into the steps. The sooner they can get into the steps, the better. And sometimes people's stories don't align that way. They were in AA for a long time before they got into step work, or they kind of had to fall into they had to trust the fellowship first and then fall into the steps. And they had to, like, okay, that's good, like, great. What's the end all be all? They fell into the steps, right? And then because of a spiritual awakening as a result of the step, which is a promise in the 12th step, that's a promise. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, if the case is that I have a spiritual illness and only a spiritual experience will conquer it, the promise is in the 12th step that I'm going to have one. There you go. I guess the point would be, let's get to that 12th step. Right? Because if I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, rock on, that's good. That's the treatment to alcoholism, is a spiritual awakening. And it turns out the steps are the result. Like, give me that result. Like, good. So let's get to there. It's the same thing with like weight loss or something. It's like, you know, okay, some people lose weight really quickly and some people it takes a long time to do so. And either way, progress is what it's about. If they're making progress, then good. Like that's what this thing is really about. So our fourth step, we move on, right? So as we go through, we could, there's a lot to read about resentments in here, which are it's super strong, but we've got to make sure we dive into, because I've only got a few more minutes here, the different other parts of the inventory. So on page 67, it talks about the fear inventory, right? So fear inventory, the resentment inventory is a four-column inventory. And again, like, I'm pretty old school. Like, Bill Wilson did not write a four-column fourth step in his bed in Towns Hospital. Like that, that's not what he wrote. He wrote literally names on the back of an envelope, and those were the people he was angry at. And then he brought those. And then when Ebby came to visit him, there you go. That's had a sponsor too, by the way. If a sponsor goes into rehab, like, you're supposed to go visit him and like do step work with him. But anyway, Ebby went and visited Bill, and then saw him there, and they went through and talked about those resentments and why he was angry at these folks, right? And then what the other action was, and the other action right after that for the Oxford group, which was Ebby was a part of at that time, was to make amends to those people. Those people that are on that list. He said he had a long talk with his friend, is what he said in his story. And if you dive into the history of it, like, it was just a list of people like on there. So the book tells me to do a four-column inventory, which is the way I was taught to take the inventory. So that's what I did. So I wrote that four-column inventory. I shared it with my sponsor. Then there's a two-column fear inventory, right? So it's like I list the fear and why I have it, and then I kind of take each fear with the question, right? Was it self-reliance that failed me within these fears? Was it me relying on me that created a lot of these fears? And some of them it's yes, and some of them it's kind of, and some of them it's maybe. But that's the fear inventory there. Fear, as it tells me, is an evil and corroding thread. Right? Our lives are shot through with it. And it says we must be rid of fear or it kills us. That's what the book says. Right? So fear is a part of this whole thing. It told me earlier in step 3, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion. Right? I'm driven by it. So I must be rid of fear. It says the way the book tells us is we commenced to outgrow fear. Commenced means to begin. Right, to outgrow fear. So it's like my kids outgrow their clothes. Does that mean the clothes cease to exist? No. They just have a different use now. Fear is something that can actually help us be, so if I'm afraid of whatever, and if I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, fear doesn't go away. I have a different use for it. Like that fear now can all of a sudden be like, wow, like, what's the fear? How am I looking at this? And then I can inventory it and see, why do I have this fear? Okay, it's because of X, Y, and Z. And what's the best way to be rid of fear? I don't know. Help somebody else. Right? Turns out the book always reverts back to that. Right? The simple kit of spiritual tools that's laid at my feet is learning how to be kind and loving toward all. Right? Even on page 19, it tells us our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we can meet their needs. Page 19 tells me that my life depends on my constant thought of others. Therefore, when I get blocked off from the spirit, or as it said in the third step, the bondage of self, when I'm locked in self, what do I get to do? Because I'm still breathing in and out, because I'm still alive, what gives me relief is going to God and helping somebody else. That is the perpetual circle that will constantly get me out of every jam or scrape that life can put at me, right? It calls it constant trials and low spots, right? That's what's going to happen through life. I wish I could tell you that everything's going to be awesome and you're going to just float through the, wear life like a loose garment, as they say. You know, that old timer used to say that. Wear life like a loose garment. It's just going to be, and as the great philosopher Gavin Rossdale from Bush said, like everything's zen, right? So it's like, that's, okay, cool. Like that would be nice. I would like that. That would be cool. Unfortunately, God sees fit to keep me with some shortcomings. My shortcomings and defects of character are the best thing to happen to the newcomer in AA. Why? Because I have to help them in order to be relieved of them. Right? So that's another nice little way to look at shortcomings and defects of character. It's like, oh, I'm working on this shortcoming and I want it to go away. Like, okay, that's well and good. You can't fix that. If you could remove your shortcomings, you would have done it already before you walked in the room. So let's pretend like you didn't say that. What's the best way to kind of lessen the load of those shortcomings and defects of character? Is to pass the rock, is what they say, right? There's a book called Drop the Rock, and it's take those resentments and offer them to God, and offer whatever those things are, the shortcomings, defects, this big boulder rock on your back, is to offer it for God to take away, and then help somebody else. That is it. I've never felt more free in my life than sitting in a church basement one-on-one with someone with a book open, possibly writing inventory, possibly hearing inventory. I've never felt more free in my life. Because I'm not thinking about me. Like any time there's something that I can do to not think about me, I am more free than ever before. Because what happens is I go back out in the world and I start thinking about me. I start thinking about the money I need to make, or I start thinking about the food I need to provide, or I start thinking about this, and then it's, well, I need to do this better and I'm not good at this, and it's just constant whirlwind. It's like, how do we get out of that? It's like, let's find someone who needs help and help them. Does that necessarily mean only in AA? No, but it's a great place because people are really hurting here. Like there's people that come into AA just like I did over and over and over again. I was hurting bad, like lower than low, right? And I come in with a smile on my face, I'm a collared shirt, like I'm doing okay, right? It's like, it's rough, right? So we got to jump in the hole with them, right? We got to jump down in there with them and say, you know, I know a way out of here. Like let's do this. Right, that's the whole thing. Shouting at them from the top of the hole that they need to do X, Y, and Z, and they should be doing this, and they go did this, and did. It's not going to help. Not going to help. Drill sergeant's not going to help from the top of the hole. One of the other recruits has to jump in there and show them a way out. Like that's what this whole thing is really for. So as we talk, then fear, right? It tells me, I write this and I write all those fears. It says we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. This is the top of 68. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. But it made us cocky, maybe worse. Right, so it rolls through, and then there's prayers in there. So there's resentment. There's one resentment prayer, one fear prayer, and three sex prayers. Right, which is where on page 69 where we review our sex conduct. Right, sex conduct is another four column inventory. Where as far as sex conduct, we write those people or whatever. We write that stuff down, and then we write healthy or not. And then there's a whole thing. Like we reviewed our conduct over the years. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom did we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? There's your sex conduct inventory. We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Right? Like, that's the reason we write it on paper. I've had a lot of people say, well, I could just rip it from the top of my head. Well, I bet you can, but that doesn't mean you're going to look at it. Like, that's part of the process. I remember my inventory. Like, I can picture it right now. I remember the handwriting, where it was. Like I remember it because I actually looked at it. It's a fact-facing, it's a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. Like what it says, a commercial inventory is. We did the same thing with our lives. We have to face it. We have to look at it. We know it's there. We know it's in here. It's all in here. It's all in here. We know it. We got to get it out and on paper. So once we do that, right? What do we do with it then? Right, so that's when we dive into showing it and sharing it with somebody else. We invite God in. So next week, we're going to kind of dive into fifth step territory. We'll probably lump in 6, 7, and 8 because they're all on the same page. And then maybe we'll dive into amends either the next week a little bit and then the week after. So we're just going to kind of wander through our step work here. So I appreciate you guys again having me. It's awesome to be here. I like this group. So anything that you need, any questions, comments, concerns, nonviolent disagreements, please feel free to discuss those. So thank you. All right.